Let's go.
Welcome to Micromobility, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of small electric vehicles. We cover the best companies building these amazing new vehicles, as well as topics relevant to how they impact people, cities, and our planet. My name is Oliver Bruce, an investor in mobility and climate tech, and my co-host is Horace Dedieu, founder of Asimco.com and Micromobility Industries.
Hey team, Oliver here. I'm traveling this week, so this will be a short one, but I am really excited to share this episode with the team from Onyx Motorbikes, who are based in Los Angeles. I visited Onyx when I was in Southern California in January as part of the SoCal Micromobility Tour. They are the winners of this year's Riders' Choice Awards for Best Moped, and it was great to hear the story of how they got started and managed to ship more than 5,000 bikes. Again, deep respect to anybody who has just managed to ship and get vehicles out. They've built a real cult following, and I am excited to see where they get to with their new bike range, which we discuss. Of course, if you like this, you will love Micromobility Europe and America. We have Micromobility Europe coming up June 8th and 9th, and then Micromobility America October 19th and 20th in the Bay Area. I am very excited for both of these events. We're going to have thousands of the top thinkers and builders in the space coming together to hang out, and I will be there, Horace will be there, James will be there. You will have an absolute blast if you come and join us. Please go and find some tickets on micromobility.io. And we're looking forward to seeing you there. And with that, here is Tim and James.
Let's go.
Welcome, everyone, to the Micromobility Podcast. This is a first trial of the SoCal Tour. So, yeah, thank you very much for having with me. So, Tim and James, founders of Onyx, and I've been out today and had a look at their bikes and the RCR, the laser. You can see it in the background here. It's looking awesome. And I just wanted to, like, take you... Yeah, I mean, it's been such an interesting story. I think... I've been following you guys right since those early days of the Indiegogo, and but you know, and like,
yeah, we love hearing that though. Yeah. I mean, we get that feedback a lot, but it's beautiful.
Yeah. So I just wanted to take the time today to, one, dig in a little bit more, understand your story and where you guys came from and how you got to starting this, and then and what the, you know, what you're excited about. So
sure, get start with the history. I think Tim could definitely start with the thing.
History goes really far back, but we kind of just glaze over it.
When I was born.
I've liked Volkswagen since I was a kid, but that's really not relevant. But I'm super into mopeds and cars and everything. And back in 2012, building mopeds with my friends, we kind of got the idea of, you know, building an electric moped. And that didn't really go anywhere. And years later, when I was at LG and where I met James, we were doing a lot of Skunkworks projects, and some of the ideas we had around there, we're thinking about rideshare and everything. And what came out of that personally was just electrifying one of my mopeds. And I started to build a bunch of prototypes, riding it around San Francisco.
What year was that?
That was in 2015, awesome. 2016.
Yeah.
And so riding around San Francisco, a lot of people were asking me where, you know, the last prototype that I made, the more crude prototypes, no one was asking me where to buy it.
Yeah.
Right. But the one that you see now, the RCR,
it's not a prototype still.
So I was riding around. It was my final build. And I did it more for myself to kind of get, you know, the moped community has a lot of custom builds, but they're all gas powered. And I wanted to be a little different, you know, because everyone's done everything under the moon under gas. And so I was, you know, just thinking if to kind of get noticed in that community, I was going to do something that was just as fast or faster than the heavily modified mopeds.
Yep.
And so I built, you know, the final design and riding around, and people were just, you know, every stoplight. And this, the crazy thing about it is you will hear customers say the same thing every time they stop. Or when they're riding,
still today, people
will say, "Where do I get that?" So
breaker.
Yeah, and so when that was happening to me, being an industrial designer doing all sorts of, you know, designs for big corporations, I was just like, "This is the time that I can do this for myself, right? I can design something, I could see how it sticks." And so I put it on Indiegogo, and I mean, it wasn't just that easy, but I put it on Indiegogo, and it
it just took off. And it took off way more than I had anticipated.
Yep.
And so that's where I got kind of into a situation where I've done a lot of personal design projects where I could totally manage myself. It takes me about a year to kind of go through and deliver all the product and then just move on to my next kind of personal project. And that's at least how I viewed Onyx in the beginning. And then when it was time to, it was getting really close to the point where Onyx needed to continue selling, or it was just going to deliver on the products that were sold.
Yep.
And then close.
Yep.
And I had to make that decision. And so I started talking to James about how can I find someone to help me? Yeah. And we just went through all these crazy things. And
there was so much momentum like at that time. Like, yeah, it was crazy. Like, it was an unstoppable wave of interest and intrigue. And yeah, it could have been contained to like you were saying, like a low volume thing, but it, like, the intensity just wouldn't have it, you know?
Well, yeah, I think what, at least, I don't know, James, you can speak to this, but when we started getting investor interest, which we didn't take any investment, but we started getting interest, there was just, you know, other competitors were thinking about buying out the company, and then Bird came in, and they came up with all these different plans and scenarios, and the one that ultimately that I chose was to let Onyx continue while I went to go be their director of industrial design, and then James would continue to, you know, essentially they funded to continue the company.
They injected a little bit of capital, but it was, I mean, I was just helping Tim every day after work. Like, I was at Amazon Lab 126 at the time working on really top secret in their hardware division, small prototype team on top secret projects. It was unlimited budgets.
Yep.
Do anything you wanted, all the laboratories you could want, from lasers to chemicals to 3D printing. I mean, it was unreal. But I mean, I just liked working with this guy. We did impossible things at LG. So to continue that momentum and help with a really fucking rad project, and it's excuse my expletives.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, yep. That's fucking awesome. it naturally, you know, as that transition, I was trying to help with it, you know, his endeavors with the investments and with the product development. But that's, you know, as the Indiegogo bikes were starting to be delivered and then the online store launched, I mean, that was an onslaught. The online store had to be turned off at a certain point in time because of the back orders were getting too crazy. But we were learning on the fly. It's huge, like building a manufacturing process. Like, you know, and Tim had previous projects that, you know, you did on Indiegogo, procuring parts and stuff like that. But this was on a different magnitude. Like, it would be like several orders of magnitude, like larger. And yeah, we were scrappy, and that's how we've always worked and figuring it out. But it's super bootstrap. Like, he was building bikes, I was building bikes, I was delivering bikes anywhere from San Jose to Sacramento to save money. Like,
oh, wow.
Slept on the floor of the warehouse.
Even
though it was a 6-minute ride away,
yep,
like to my house, I just was so exhausted trying to get bikes onto the truck the night before. It's just,
to put it in perspective, how crazy it was. So how I was able to get the warehouse where we could build the bikes, and essentially the warehouse was so small that you could only fit about 50 builds in there. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to take them out. You'd have to take them out to actually be able to do production, but then stuff them back in. But how I got that warehouse is, back when I was 19, I helped start a skateboard company with some friends, and we got that warehouse, and it had been there for 20 years and the company was going out of business. They called me back right at the right time when I was at LG, called me back, and they said, "Hey, we need to liquidate the whole company. You know the product the best. Can you come back and liquidate it?" And I was kind of like, I'm going to be out of a job if I do that, right?
Yeah.
So I thought, my wheels were working, and I said, wait, I want to do this Onyx thing. So I said, if I can move Onyx in while I'm moving this skateboard company out. So I was essentially pushing Onyx in while pushing the skateboard company out. And He got the company while that was happening, and it was just crazy. And to really put it in perspective, is the skateboard company, just like Onyx, were building products in the United States. So there is competing for floor space where we're going to assemble skateboards and where we're going to assemble bikes. And of course, the bikes take up way more room.
Yeah, totally.
And those first ones as well, like they would.
Yeah.
So they were frame, like you were getting all the stuff imported, and then you just had to stock it and then assemble it here, right? Like it was.
Yeah. There was some electronics I was getting done in Sacramento in the very early stages, but eventually it was just way more cost effective.
There were some items we were sourcing for locally as well. Treatland in the beginning was helping us out.
That's true. That's true.
Big, you know, moped aftermarket parts supplier. But yeah, eventually everything just transitioned over there, but a little efficiencies along the way, but still for all intents and purposes, same, parts coming in, different process. And yeah, right. Definitely. But,
and just so we can get a sense of like where you're at now. So you have how many bikes have you shipped? Where have you got to?
Bike shipped in total since inception. Gosh, okay, so that number was probably close to 5,000 bikes shipped.
Yeah, awesome.
I mean, probably sub that a little bit,
yep,
give or take, but a significant amount for building like brute force in-house,
totally.
Burning all the wrenches for all the bolts, all the nuts. Yeah, it's definitely impressive.
And a lot of in the early days too, which I think also kind of really slowed down production, but also really helped gain a really strong following, is that we allowed for custom builds and custom orders. So, I mean, he actually really kind of pushed that for a long time. There was just people would come in and they'd want different bars, different looks, different paint jobs. Currently, that's, you know, a little bit harder to do in the production cycle that we have.
Due to demand,
yeah. It's just we can't build custom and frames.
I mean, this is a good problem to have, boys.
Yeah. It's still a problem though. That's why, you know, yeah, people say that, but I'm like, it's still a problem to be solved, but yeah, we're solving it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I like that one that we saw out in the workshop, which is the all purple or all pink one. And like, you know, people have like really taken it to a new level of.
Yeah. All the employee bike parking over here, we should go through that too. It's all different candy bits and different candy ways, but it's a very personal relationship with a bike with it. And a lot of, and any vehicle, but a bike in particular, even if it's from a sticker that you put on the bike to full overhaul and performance, you know? Yeah.
And so you started with the Yasia, and then as I remember as well, you had the city bike, the original.
So the CTY was essentially, the RCR and the CTY share the same frame, right?
Yep.
So I was able to build from prototype's perspective, I was able to make the CTY pretty quickly because literally the only thing that was different was the battery box. All the other components were the same. And I did change the colors a little bit. And that product, you know, initially didn't take off because everyone wanted, you know, the high powered RCR.
Yep.
And CTY was just powered at, you know, almost every other e-bike. So I think people just had an appetite for something that was completely different and off the wall. But when we brought the CTY, or when he brought the CTY back, it's so much more powerful than the original.
It definitely should not be understated. Launching a product that is designed that caters to two different like form factors, performance levels, like that's not something like your average e-bike company is going to go to. I mean, eloquently designing a bike and then changing it for two completely different applications, users, approachability, barriers of entry. It's pretty impressive, you know, and with just minor changes, you know. Yeah.
So you started out with those two and you've just launched the LZR laser. Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, LZR. We're anti-vowels.
Yeah.
It's Racer. Yes. Yeah. Racer, RCR.
Yeah. Catch you, City.
City. But, yeah, you know, you could consider a Y a vowel.
I hear you. Yeah.
And sometimes.
So, yeah. And then the LZR, also laser, right, with the Z.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Beauty. And so with the laser as well, because that laser, that was the thing that really like struck me when I went, before I came here and I was on your website, I was like, oh crap, like you're doing dirt bikes and like BMX bike style stuff as well, right? Because I remember when I first came across it, I was like, this is kind of hilarious. It's almost like a moped, but it's got pedals on it. So it's right, sort of an interesting e-bike, maybe your way to get around the rigs, da 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 da. But the LZR, I was like, full on, like, you're going and going for a very niche particular dirt bike or dirt jumper market. And that's quite new. Like, that's only just launched.
That just launched in the summer.
Yep.
It started with that, the drawing on that whiteboard right there.
Oh, awesome.
It designed from the ground up. But yeah, I think Tim can speak to
that. Yeah, so I think we were coming from the perspective of, I mean, we both like the skateboard and, thinking of the market, right, the e-bike market, it just hasn't hit that pinnacle of, like, high performance, experience kind of riding. And you think of, like, any other market that's, let's say board sports, for example, snowboard, surfing, skateboarding, they all have a pinnacle of riding styles, and they all do some insane stunts and tricks with those products. And if you look at e-bikes, I mean, you kind of have some electric mountain bikes that are doing some tricks, but really those companies aren't pushing that. And so we thought, okay, to break through that, what out there is doing that? And then, there are some companies that are doing BMX, electric BMX bikes, but they're still not pushing through that barrier, the pinnacle of, like, what you can do with the product. Mm-hmm. And so we saw these dirt jumping videos that they're not powered. There's no dirt jumping electric bikes out there at all. And we're just like, well, we're the company to do it. I mean, there's no, if anyone's going to push something that's totally out of the ordinary.
And not sacrifice on, like, quality, on performance, on design elements. We're not a compromising, philosophy in any endeavor. Like, this has high design precision, not sacrificing on performance. But if you look at the other, like, say, electric BMX bikes, it's like, there's cutting corners for the bottom line. They're using off-the-shelf batteries and stuff like that. So you're not going to be doing backflips on it. It's like, appeal for the mass market, maybe working towards this aspirational pull, but can you actually take it to the skate park? Can you take it to, these crazy huge jumps that you're going to be hitting on a dirt jump or hardtail or downhill mountain biking? Absolutely not. Like, that battery will shake off in a minute. But we wanted to make sure that we hit the performance metrics, hit the quality standards, and have high structural integrity to actually conquer and overconquer that. And I think I mentioned earlier, like, it's adding to the experience and your performance, not taking away by adding all the bells and whistles. So that's why, we kept it in the minimalist manner and not having all the shifters or buttons or screens on the handlebars, but we're adding to the ability of the rider by utilizing electric powertrain to get over that bigger jump that you couldn't hit before, to get up that hill and really enjoy the experience even more, but without taking away from it.
Yeah, and I think the story that I have, that when we were first testing it, because at first, it's just a really best. It's our best guess, right? We both aren't doing backflips on this bike, right?
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, okay, if we can find someone to do a backflip or do a 360 on it, then it's going to be a little bit easier from there. But really, what I figured out at one of the dirt jump parks, so when we first brought it out and just let the kids ride around on it and stuff, one of the kids came back and he just said, there's this huge double that I have so much trouble getting over it, and I'm always scared that I'm not going to land it. He said, in between the double, I just give it two little pedals, and I have it this boost that just makes it so much easier for me.
That's a great example
to clear it. And I literally was like, this is it. It's still to say, when I'm telling you, it gives me chills, because it's one of those things in those moments that, I was looking for backflips in 360s, but it was literally like a 14-year-old kid that said, it's so much easier for me to do this and have the confidence to do this jump. And then later that day, they introduced us to one of our first riders who got on it, and, he was started to do the line, and then he did a 360, and then he did a backflip, and then he started riding it so hard that he broke one of the parts on it. This is in the initial testing phase. Frame was completely solid, had no problems. We immediately called off the manufacturer of the fork to make the steer tube steel instead of aluminum. And what we're realizing is that a lot of the e-bike components are just, they just don't hold up to that sort of punishment. So like the crank arms and certain other things that we've had to
components to, inside the motor.
Yeah, the, like, yeah, we've had the components. Motor, so we went through a lot of rigorous testing really quickly, got it switched out and modified to actually be able to take a beating. And the last thing is why the frame never actually, you know, had any problems is because I learned a lot at being a bird for 3 years, right? How to make it an indestructible vehicle.
Totally.
And while it looks beautiful from the outside, there's a lot of ribbing and internal structures that make it so much stronger than you would think. It's not just hollow tubes like a bird bone that would just break and, you know.
Like,
no. Nope. We didn't go over that part of it in the history, but I do actually, like, that to me was actually one of the, like, really interesting elements of your story together, is that you were doing this and then you disappeared for a couple of years. Yeah. You know?
I was just over there.
But can you just talk us through, because I think what you know, like, for a lot of listeners, you know, they might be interested in this stuff, but I think if they're generally interested in the industry, your story is so fascinating.
Right. So going to Bird was...
As the head of industrial design, by the way.
The director of industrial design. So I was literally tasked with coming up with all sorts of crazy concepts and designs, and only a fraction of what we were coming up with there actually made it into production. Namely, you know, like the Bird 2, 3, and then we were working on a fourth one, and there was some mopeds that did briefly get out there that I designed, and that was collaboration with Juiced. And what I learned there was just how to make, you know, global vehicles that were literally indestructible at a really low cost. And for me, that's what was exciting about the opportunity, right? Is I love to learn. I'm a professor. I haven't been teaching for a couple of years now, but I'm a professor at CCA, which is California College of the Arts. And just the one thing about being a teacher is it's also always about learning, right? It's not just about teaching, but it's also about learning new things. And so I knew that being able to go and you know, I obviously looked at the engineers that I was going to work with, and a lot of them came from Faraday Future. Some came from NASA, which is insane to think that they had some NASA employees went to.
But also, awesome.
Right, it's also awesome. Yeah. And so we were learning how to make a scooter survive under, you know, 20 feet of seawater for 2 years. Like crazy, crazy stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where it's just on top of being able to drop scooters off of, you know, 5-story buildings and they won't break. But
just in case you're riding. And
yeah. So,
through terrain.
So it's great because, I mean, all of our future vehicles are going to have that knowledge applied to them, of just kind of the things that I've learned. And then, and I think the great thing is that just having James be able to, like he always said, he's like, as soon as we're in that position to bring you back, you know.
And that's what I said when, you know, the last day before he took off. I'll rewind a little bit. I'm like, because, I mean, I already explained a little bit. I'm like, It's really unique to have someone like that you work with, that whatever comes out the other end is going to be something insane and special, because we actually give a shit. And I feel like that passion is rare. It's like the bottom line or the market opportunity or like fitting into a segment or, you know, the margins or something like that. No, it's stuff we're interested in. It's something that's gonna put our heart and soul into. And it's the genuineness will always translate at the end of the day. And that's definitely what we've seen. But to put a little bit more color around the transition, Tim definitely has brought back like a lot of learnings, you know, in the industry and production and manufacturing, structural integrity. There's like so much to be learned there. During that period, I explained before we kind of got on, was I was just helping in the background just because I liked working on cool projects and I liked working with Tim. But, you know, it wasn't the most seamless transition. There was, you know, trials and tribulations and figuring out directions and endeavors. But it was a scratch build company from the ground up, from the design, from the manufacturing to the procuring of parts, to the delivery, to logistics, to everything in that still all had to be figured out and all had to be maintained. You know, when I took over it, it was me, 3 technicians, 1 immediately quit. And then, like, but it, I mean, it, that's it, cultivating the community, I mean, the rider community was, I mean, already inspirational, and Tim was the one who cultivated that and that momentum there. But ensuring that, you know, getting the people, the bikes that invested in the Indiegogo, it was a driving force behind ensuring that we were putting everything in the right places and just having that complete commitment and investment to, even though it's an impossible hill to climb, there was a way to figure it out and make it happen. And there was too much beauty and too much good things going on that there's no way that there was going to be any corners cut or sacrificing on anything or letting this, you know, dwindle into non-existence. So there's a huge driving force on my part when I took over to figure out, I didn't know anything about, you know, international relations, figuring parts from China, like at a list, you know, it was very scrappy and bootstrap, but slowly but surely, you know, a little bit of pieces here, like getting...
Because it was 2018, and then you came in...
Into 2019.
2019.
May 2019, yep. I took over. So we had shipped like, how many things, like 80 bikes, 60 bikes?
It was a couple hundred. A lot of them just needed a couple extra parts. I think there were some issues in the beginning of some of the manufacturing issues just had to be figured out. But I mean, I think the what we were trying to say is just that it went from a project to a real company, and then he took it from a project to a real company. It was more of a it was more set up to be sort of a short term project, and although it looks from the outside, from all the experience that I have, and, you know, developing Indiegogos, that it looked like this is a real company. They're gonna go on forever. So we, in a way, he was setting. Yeah.
You had it here first, folks.
This is not my fault. Yeah, I was a prototype engineer working on buying the Sky project.
Yeah, but,
you know, taking over this. You know, I applied it. Like, there's no impossible endeavor I've ever tried to approach and never been able to. Achieve, you know, to a certain degree, but I looked at it the same way. It's an impossible thing. I know nothing about. I'm gonna have to learn all the things I need to know. But the different derivatives of that were just astronomical.
And you guys managed to sell bikes. I mean, this is the thing that's kind of crazy. Is, you know, and did you end up taking much external funding?
No, zero.
Oh, right. So yeah, there's a very interesting story of like a whole bunch of folks who've managed to fund through Indiegogo who have. You know, that has been the definitive feature of how they've managed to survive. Like,
no, they needed funding.
Yeah, they didn't get funding. Like, it's but like, there's a whole bunch of them who went off and got a heaps of funding, right? And I think that there's an element of being able to match that funding to shipping, right? And like, look at, and I don't mean to bag your former employer, but like, you know, like when you have too much funding, it actually can be a problem.
And, oh yeah,
big time. Yeah, and that's part of the reason I didn't in the beginning. There's a part being very naive, then there was part being, you know, not wanting to have to be beholden to investors that only concentrated on the bottom line. I didn't want to have to go forced to buy cheaper parts. I didn't want to have to force to change the direction, the vision of the company, which is incredibly important. Some, you know, at any given point, it could have been, you know, people could have come in and bastardized, like, or just neutered the project and the value points we're trying to work on. So people were trying to throw money at us left and right. It was just crazy. But you know, due to the investment of listening to the community, being engaged and integrating their genuine feedback into a lot of the features and the different options that got added to the RCR came straight from the community. But having that engagement and that involvement from like as sort of grassroots manner, I don't have a better word for it, it just really resonated with people. This isn't a big company with a bunch of money that is trying to just address the whole market in this disingenuous way as a money grab. I mean, that it's obvious to people, you know, in a lot of ways. There's nothing wrong with it necessarily.
Yeah.
I believe in supporting anybody that is contributing to the two-wheel, you know, community, it's a good thing. But doing it our own way, I didn't want to sacrifice any sliver of the amount of care, love, attention, and quality and performance that we wanted to aspire to. So,
and I think from the design perspective, it's, you know, like being at Bird, there's a lot of funding. We can make a bunch of projects. I think, you know, we could have had funding. I could have tried to get funding, which I did in the beginning, you know, working with, you know, other engineering teams or other design teams. I was actually talking early in the stages, I was talking to McKinsey, and they were really interested in becoming a partner, mainly on the engineering side of the business. But the thing that you, when you have those kind of like relationships, it's, there's one really positive from the design side is I could have done almost anything under the moon, but looking back at it, I actually kind of like the way that we set it up, because initially I realized that I wasn't, when I started the Indiegogo and started having to do fulfillment and starting to have to like really focus on the business, I realized I was not going to be a designer for probably 3 years. And that's literally about the time that it took for James to figure out the business that I could come back and full-time design, because like design is really what I love to do. I'm an artist kind of at heart, and I just, you know, I wanted to do some really great things, but I didn't have the funding to do it.
Yeah.
And so it was great to just kind of take some of those ideas, go to Bird, learn a lot, can come back.
Yep.
Yeah. It was a super big dream when, like, you know, I spoke to, like, you know, literally when Tim was taking off, like, in his car. I remember this moment very clearly. Like, I'm going to make sure I bring you back here. It was an empty promise completely. Because I'm like, don't have, like, you know,
any idea how I'll do this. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Two fucking, you know, nickels to rub together and a process that I astronomically still needed to figure out. But throughout the endeavors and, you know, traversing the territory and trying to, you know, dealing with all the trials and tribulations, we started getting to a point that we can entertain, which is just a wild feat in and of itself. But yeah, it's time to, you know, we launched two new products last year with no funding, which is insane through all the other, you know, business. Well, all the business relationships that, you know, have been reaching out recently. So, but it's, you know, I think we're now at a point where it's not, you know, hunkered down to the grassroots. Like, you know, we're still going to keep that without sacrificing it, but leverage some of the opportunities in the business capacity, which is something I can humbly say is I had the hard way of learning over time. So, yeah.
Yeah. And fascinating.
And yeah. And, kind of put it into perspective again, is that coming back, I'm looking at, you know, 5-10 years out of what Onyx can be. Mm-hmm. And a hint of that is just Onyx will eventually remove the name Motorbikes and it will be Onyx, you know, essentially just Onyx, and it'll be a transportation company. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, right now we're focusing on bikes, but we have, you know, much larger ambitions that we're, you know, starting to figure out that roadmap.
Yeah, there's no limit to our impossible dreams. Like, for real, it's, and we know they're achievable. We've done it before. So,
because how big's the team now?
We were at 25 recently. We went through a little bit of shifting and downsizing for strategical, like, purposes, but, and that's just full-time. We've got a bunch of fractional, part-time, you know, a lot of people are involved in all the business development and stuff like that. But still, I mean, that's not a lot of people to leverage competing to be a home name brand next to some of the other players in the field.
Totally.
So we've been talking a lot. I'm sure maybe you have a lot more questions.
Well, I do. Yeah, no. Where I want to go to with this is actually going, so at the moment you do D2C. Like, so people buy the bikes online, they get shipped to them. Why did you choose to go that way versus a more traditional route of distribution? And then what else are you thinking of in terms of distribution, if you can mention any of that?
Well, first, I'll be honest, it was, I mean, I've been very direct about my lack of experience, like, in the business world. So the idea of sales, completely not on my radar. Like, I mean, outwardly looking for people to come by or even needing to do that, we were so blessed with just the inundation of people coming to us. So everything had just gone D2C. Orders would come in. And our back order of bikes was 3 months for the first 2 years. And it was in the orders of like 150 bikes plus. And, you know, keeping up with that was already crazy. So I didn't even have the opportunity to think about, you know, going and growing in that capacity. So But learning about it, understanding the interest, especially in the international capacity, which we're still, you know, we're on the verge of being able to give ourselves the capability to do. Domestically, I mean, there's 350 million Americans, right? So there's bike distributors, and it's such a unique product. It's like getting it out to the people in front of eyes. You know, we mentioned that the bike, if you get to a stoplight, it's breaking necks, and we need like pamphlets to hang the same. What's the range? What's the top speed? How long does it take to charge? You know, to give out. But it's that.
Do you ship those? Do you ship pamphlets with the bike?
We should.
What the ultimate marketing strategy? Oh, I have one of these already prepared for you. Yeah,
yeah, laminated. You know, going out. We did for some of our ambassadors. We got them business cards for the contact information and stuff like that. But no, it but the same laundry list and questions were answered. But the point being is that exposure had a viral effect. And the more bikes it got out there, it made more people aware of, you know, us, the product even existing. So it brought that to light of many people. And so a lot of people that had unfortunately purchased other bikes, they were exposed to Onyx, and then they're like, all right, I just sold my X, Y, and Z, I won't say any bike brands, but then to come and get an Onyx. But it's now time to bring like bikes out to the people and get the brands out there. We don't have all the money in the world, like the, you know, Mercedes e-bikes or, you know, X, Y, and Z. We're talking about large investment companies, but we're doing it in a genuine way, the word of mouth, and we stick to our guns. And so we've got a lot of weight behind us.
Yeah. And with the bikes, cause I'm very curious, like these are obviously, they're technically an e-bike,
mm-hmm.
but they've got a whole bunch of power. So how does that work from a categorization perspective? And then how do you think about that in terms of like what channels might look like?
Yeah, I, you know, I've worked with NHTSA, National Highway Transportation Safety Agency, for about a year. I think that was maybe even a year ago. And our bike has, like the RCR specifically at that time, it has 3 speed modes. So it tops out at either 20 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour, or top speed. Our first mode is completely e-bike compliant. So it limits the bike. And having a governance system on the bike is very important. The other two modes are for off-road use only. And it's like, the way I compare it to is like a Lamborghini, it goes 200 miles an hour. Don't break the law and go 200 miles an hour. You shouldn't be going 200 miles per hour.
Yeah. No, 100%. I've felt this. And I know that like Van Moof has felt that as well. Might have seen the Van Moof V that they've designed as well. And they're like 50 miles an hour, similar to this, because it's like we should be having that conversation. I think it's a general one that we should be having in the industry.
I agree. And I think people have a different perspective on this industry. And I'm still trying to define it like succinctly, but it's not the same way as like you would apply to cars. It's like, let me drop a V8 in my Honda Civic or in my Miata and go infinitely fast. No one, you know, bats an eye at that. But in this e-bike, aren't you afraid of getting regulated? It's like, no, this is more efficient, more effective, less space being taken up. Cityscapes could be totally like Swiss cheesed by all these. I mean, 80% or I think it's 60-70% of cityscapes are built around sleeping cars. I mean, parking structures, parking lots, street parking, all these like 3,000 pound cages that people are driving around in inefficiently, ineffectively. It's like hundreds of thousands of motors where it's so unnecessary. It's so unnecessary. You're carrying all this weight. I mean, I'm pretty passionate about it, but yeah.
I can tell. And I'm curious, did that come about? Were you as passionate about this when you started?
When I started, to be honest, I was very much driven about being a throttle junkie and wanting to zip around and fling myself across the earth as fast as I could. Always been focused, I mean, on having as much of a positive influence on as many people as possible has been a driving factor in my professional career and my own endeavors always. So I'm not pigeonholed in like a very selfish way. There is some aspects of that, I won't lie. But applying it to a larger picture, like theoretically, philosophically, it's important for, especially with translating to cultivating a good crew and like the people you work with, cultivating a good rider base and the how you treat and interact people that, you know, support your product. It's much bigger than that. And yeah,
totally,
it makes sense.
Can I ask where you're going to next? Like, where do you think, you know, so you were saying 5 years, 5 years or 10 years. Sure. Out. Like, what's
have you heard of the moon?
In the near future, we're going to go higher performance, higher tolerances. You know, we're going to utilize like higher, like better capabilities than in manufacturing.
We don't want to compromise. Sorry. I think is what he's speaking to. Yeah. Right. Like, yeah.
The type of the manufacturing method of the RCR. So let's say the laser manufacturing method is sort of just at the very low end of the pinnacle of where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the RCR uses a lot of traditional methods. It's cut, bend, weld.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Very like those are literally the only things that you need to do to be able to make an RCR. Whereas there's forging, there's injection molding, there's all sorts of other methods of manufacturing, and that's more at a higher caliber. And being able to do the RCR in that traditional method is fine for that design because it also is a retro kind of design. So having that retro style of manufacturing is also, I think, what makes and gives it its character. But when you're moving into, you know, when we're moving into the future and looking to really expand globally, there's a lot of other manufacturing methods that we want to do. And then the vehicles that come around, that come behind that are not just bikes, basically. There's other vehicles beyond sort of the next bikes that we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
That get into
different spaces, different verticals. So, right, like, yeah. That's definitely from the technical, like, industrial design aspect,
right,
extremely important. But I think a lot of what Tim's summarizing is having full control over, like, the process of what we're doing without having to compromise. And it's very doable in these age of automation, stuff like that. We can go on for days, but I don't know where to throttle back my thought leadership on this, but there really is no end to, I mean, just seeing the success of what we've had. Of, you know, a lot of what's existing today in the electric vehicle market is they're taking old petrol platforms, whether it's cars, whether it's bikes. I mean, a great example is Livewire, slapping electric drivetrain on it.
Totally.
With zero effort taking in, like, to consideration the advantages and the opportunities that electric powertrain has to offer, whether it's space constraints, whether it's design opportunities, whether it's, just... the, you know, taking out elements like the auditory thing we talked about, the bike being silent, there's a lot to play with there. And that whole, you know, we have a lot of experience in the user experience optimization space, but it's not just that. We rethought that the platform and the opportunity that's there. So in my opinion, there's some approachable areas like neighborhood electric vehicles, or I don't know if I'm going to be disclosing too much.
So I would say one of the things that I think will be game changing for Onyx and the industry at large is one of the biggest pain points is range, right? Range anxiety.
Totally.
And so, I mean, there's obvious solutions out there, but really the thing is just being able to solve that range anxiety and be able to ride all day and just, you know, never have to worry about that. I think that's one of the goals that we have.
Yeah, and there's definitely
fascinated as to what that would look like. Yeah, because there's basic physics around batteries and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, but there are definitely a solutions for that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of ways to address that. But I mean, you know, thought leadership wise, like there's undefined categories of vehicles that haven't come to the public consciousness or haven't fit into what could cater to something super beneficial in terms of commuting, in terms of like optimal like sports performance. It's a blank canvas that really, you know, we're just, you know, scratching the surface of, just due to the, you know, availability of the components to build electric drive chains, some of the things there, opportunities that are being presented there. But even just with a little bit of technology that exists, like, as we've already shown in RCR, CTY, and laser, you can do so much with it. But I'm saying it could go to the end of changing infrastructure, like reclaiming some of that territory in cities, turning parking lots into parks, or taking some of the lanes on the highways or roads and turning those, other countries, they preference public transportation and bicycle lanes more than cars, and they do fantastically well, but it's going to take a mind shift that I don't think, is going to be an easy feat. But starting small, like if there was a bridge that we had introduced, or a good, that obviously shows the opportunity and the value of having your own personal electric vehicle. Another part to overcome is like the safety factor. But when you have the allocated bike lanes, you don't have to worry about someone in a 3,000-pound cage smashing you over. It's dedicated for you. And I think, in my opinion, that's an easy feat to prove and build examples around.
Totally. I mean, the one thing that I will push back on slightly about that is is the fact that, like, that bike in a bike lane, like, I've ridden one, they're quick. And I know that this is like a really big issue that they have in countries with more developed cycle infrastructure. It's like that fight between, you see it in Amsterdam and Copenhagen, all that sort of stuff, the fight between like, oh, these speed pedal X are already in there, they're going 45 Ks an hour, and they're heavy, and we're trying to like have our kids ride in these bike lanes and stuff. And so, my whole thing is, well, just build more infrastructure. I mean, they're not that big, We should, at the end of the day, have a slow speed lane and a high speed lane, like you would do it on a motorway or a highway. But
yeah, I think I started with, I mean, because I was really only familiar with the California regulations. And one of the things about the Onyx RCR and the CTY in California, it's really easy to register as a moped. I mean, it's like $19 or $23, I think now. Yeah, and it's for life. And
no way.
But yeah, you have to have an M1 and everything. I mean, the notion that you didn't need to have a license for a moped, that they, that happened in the 80s. They made it a law, but people still kind of think for some reason you can actually get a moped plate but still ride it without a license. But so you still need a license to ride a moped, and you want to go 45 max speed on the highway, highway, which is different. So in California, but you can also, which is crazy to your point of the bike lane in California, you can ride a moped in the bike lane below 25 miles an hour. That's actually a law.
Interesting.
So, okay.
Yeah.
It's like the 10 speed bicycles that go really fast.
Not a tour bike path.
Use bike lane.
You're not technically you're not allowed on a bike path, or
there's
off road or like a bike trail, but bike lane, which is in the road, you're allowed to be in there to be able to go in there. Of course, bicyclists don't either know that, or they just don't want that, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where you have to make the vehicle be able to move with the flow of traffic if you want them out of the bike lane.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll also put it this way, like more simply, is it's coming whether you like it or not. You can try to regulate it, but obvious pros to the cons like are so outweighed, like the results to me, in what I see in the industry, they're so obvious. You can try to stop people from knowingly improving the efficiency and way they're able to transport, whether they're a delivery service or a courier service or something like that. I mean, you saw it in New York. They try to ban e-bikes. It's just not possible because it's just so reasonable.
Well, it's not only that, but I just also think that there's, like, we talk about the Cambrian explosion of vehicle types, that there's going to be, it's like, oh, you ban that particular thing. It's like, well, there'll be other things that'll emerge and pop up, and people will end up wanting to use these things, right? And so I think that. Anyway, I'm really conscious of time, and so I just...
Yeah, we can go on.
For folks who do want to find out a bit more about you, like Onyx, Onyx Bikes, is it onyx.com?
It's onyxmotorbikes.com.
Yeah. Onyxmotorbikes.com. Well, we're going to have to get rid of the motorbikes.
Right.
Yeah.
Just Onyx Motor is good enough.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. It's awesome. Hey, well, look, such a pleasure to come in and have a chance to chat with you and learn a bit more about what you're doing. And the one final question I want to ask is, why do you think Southern California is such a hotspot for this stuff? Because, like, there is such a concentration of motorbikes or e-bikes or other designers or that sort of thing here?
The weather, I mean, for me personally, it would be the weather. And I mean, that's why the film industry is here. It's just, you can go out there and ride and film any day that you want. I mean, today's not a great example,
right?
But I mean, you know, 99% of the time, the weather is amazing.
Yeah, and it's really the women. So you look cool on your bike in front of the girls and you can pick up chicks. No, yeah. I'm teasing. But Southern California compared to Silicon Valley, there's obviously like the technical talent there. There is, in Santa Monica and, you know, Venice and other areas, there is the talent acquisition opportunities. But it's another part of it to put on like a marketing hat. That Southern California flair, but also we had this, you know, skateboard kind of lawless punk rock flair that, you know, was highly inspired by Tim and his experience in the skate industry and my experience. How we want to put that out there resonates with California, whether it's NorCal, whether it's SoCal.
Yep.
Putting those pieces together, it only can come out of here. And the people that are behind it can only come out of here, whether it's the creative people that have come from the Onyx like ecosystem, our photographer and then people that manage our Instagram for a very long time, Giulio Minolani and his wife, like infinitely grateful, infinitely talented. That can't be, you know, be done in other places. There's so many factors of the ecosystem that contributes. It's really a beautiful thing to see, you know, people that just get bikes and then just get so involved. That contribution is cultivated here, and you know, I think it could be only done here.
And culturally, there, I would say that, short of New York, I think Los Angeles has a really, they do have a really strong motorcycle and car culture here, and true. It literally our community grew overnight. When in San Francisco, It was like pulling teeth to get even a few riders to come out and ride with you. But here you could get hundreds of people to ride with
you.
It's day and night.
Interesting.
You know, and so really culturally, it's just it's a shift. I think maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago in San Francisco, that might be a different story. But I think just the type of people.
San Francisco treated this well, but yeah, all aspects considered. But great question.
I'm just curious. I know James, our co-host, co-founder for Micromobility Industries, is like, he's so pro on SoCal. He believes it's where it will be the new Detroit of this industry over
time. We're in the hub of aerospace. I mean, Boeing's right across the street, Lockheed Martin. I mean, all the things. But
I mean, you know, for me, I think I love the outdoors. And the one thing I do miss about NorCal is that, you know, there is some great outdoor adventure stuff out there. But here, I can literally go anywhere I want because of the kind of desert like topography. I can just ride off into the sunset, into a mountain, and not feel like a ranger is going to come around the corner and write me a ticket. Literally here, I literally feel like I can do anything I want.
Snowboarding, and it's crazy, and skateboarding in the same day.
So there's just so much more like adventure kind of lifestyle here that, although it may not be as lush and rich as like some of the forests up north, it's just. The kind of things that you can get involved in are just, I feel more like a little bit more free when I get out into the wilderness here.
Awesome.
Yeah, we could talk forever.
Awesome. Well, hey, thank you so much for this tape, and really appreciate it, and looking forward to having you.
Thank you. But thanks for coming by.
Not at all. Cool.
All right, cool. Right on in.
All right, sweet.
All right, thanks.